This is Paul Hurt and Jennifer Sweeney of Arizona State University interviewing Bob Lynch at his home in Phoenix, Arizona on January
20th,
2019.
2020.
Whoa! We have gone into a new year and a new decade. Thanks, Bob. So that's a good example of why you're such an important person to interview, because you are sharp as a tack.
I'm glad I didn't shine my shoes. Besides, it's not a new decade. It's the last year of the old decade.
Well, technically it is, but most people think it's the beginning of the new decade. But you are right about that, too. Why don't you just start out by telling us your name, the positions you held in the Adaptive Management Program, and the years that you've been involved.
Well, my full name is Robert S. Lynch. I'm an attorney here in Phoenix. Been a member of the bar since August 27th, 1964. I practice natural resources law, which is how I ended up back here, having left law school and passed the bar, been sworn in, gone into the Marine Corps, gone out of the Marine Corps into the Justice Department, and then back here to work on the Central Arizona Project. I really am not part of the Adaptive Management Program. I am essentially a spectator. I don't know if you've talked to Leslie James. Her predecessor was a guy named Joe Hunter, a lobbyist who held that executive director position. And when they were, after the criteria were adopted in 97, the Bureau and Park Service people were putting together the Adaptive Management Work Group and the Technical Work Group and said that CRETA could have two positions on each, as long as I was not either one of them. And literally, he came and told me afterwards that that was the deal, that they got two slots to keep me away. And so I've been on the sidelines watching, since that started in 97. But I've been involved in Glen Canyon Dam issues since the early 80s, when President Bush kicked off some of the, or not Bush.
That would have been Ronald Reagan in the early 80s.
There were issues with regard to Glen Canyon Dam and Lake Powell and the river. And then in 92, Bush 43 started, or got his Secretary of the Interior to start the Glen Canyon Environmental Studies. So that sort of formalized what amounted to a decade of debate over what was going on and what, you know, and all of that. So as a practical matter, I've been on the sidelines poking people ever since.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. What do you see as your role in poking people from the sidelines in the Adaptive Management Program? I mean, you're a water lawyer, among other things.
Yes.
And kind of representing the state of Arizona. On the Adaptive Management Program, there are representatives of each of the basin states and their water interests. Do you see yourself sort of in that category of somebody watching out for those issues, state water issues?
Well, I get involved in state water issues, but my clients are primarily interested in the hydropower generation from Glen Canyon Dam. While there are other hydroelectric facilities of this Colorado River Storage Project, it's 70% of that, and it's a major source of power for the small entities, the utilities that I represent in Arizona, and one in California, and so we are concerned because, you know, the smaller you are, the more important this resource is. And any particular, under the current criteria, any particular day of the week, you're leaving 600 to 800 megawatts of capacity on the table not being used, which is a power plant, you know, and not to mention load following for an enormous amount of solar or wind if you were to restructure how hydropower works. Right now, hydropower follows load rather than generation. But it can also follow generation, and it can follow both with what's called a dynamic signal. And it's an electronic signal that is sent, limited number of them, to each generation facility about what that particular utility needs. And operators at the other end have a computer program that melds those to try to adjust the operation within the parameters of operation of the dam. At Hoover, the parameters are driven by water supply and downstream water workers. Glen Canyon, the power generation is driven by the 97 criteria and the subsequent criteria and the new EIS and ROD. So people have to live within that and try to do what they can. Things are about to get interesting.
A lot is changing in the energy field today, isn't it?
Well, it's not that. It's the lawsuit. A group of environmentalists headed up by a group called Save the Colorado wrote the Bureau of Reclamation in July and said, your environmental impact statement and record of decision for LTEMP isn't any good because you failed to take into account climate change, the drought contingency plan, a couple of other things. And so that dragged on, so they filed suit. And the CRETA has intervened. I have a stack this tall that I have to get through so I can draft an intervention for my client. And it's a novel issue. Everybody talks about climate change. Everybody talks about what you ought to do about this, that, or the other thing. But to the best of my knowledge, there's one other case where the issue of climate change, it has just been brought up this year in some litigation out of Montana. It's still in the, just finished the pleading stage. And these two cases, for the first time, bring up the subject of how a dam should be operated on a river system vis-a-vis climate change. Now you add to that, that the Council on Environmental Quality came out with draft and then final guidance on how to deal with climate change in environmental impact statements last summer. I think they finalized them in August. And then came out with their proposed rewrite of certain portions of their, quote, regulations, unquote. I think the comment period on that is March 10th. And so all of a sudden, you have a changing field. One of the interesting aspects of that's going to be is that CEQ regulations aren't. Nobody talks about it. But the CEQ doesn't regulate anybody. And there's a Court of Appeals of the District of Columbia case that says so. when they were originally formulated, they were called guidance. And I wrote a law review article about how the agencies were responding to the CEQ guidance. Apparently I was the only one who did. Nobody seemed to think it was important. But then during the Carter administration, they sort of migrated into the Code of Federal Regulations, miraculously. And it wasn't until this case, which I think, I'm trying to remember, I think it was decided around 1998, I forget. I've been chasing too many ghosts. Where the Court of Appeals said, wait a minute, CEQ doesn't regulate anybody. You know, they're an advisory body in the executive office of the White House. You can put these things in the Code of Federal Regulations if you want to, but they're not regulations. Well, for one reason or another, that's not really gotten a lot of traction. But with this issue of climate change and CEQ jumping into that in the context of NEPA, it is going to get much more, this is like the old Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times. No, this is going to be huge, and people don't understand. You know, I'm not even sure the attorneys involved understand how big, how watershed an issue this is. But we'll find out. Interestingly enough, the judge to which the case was assigned is the former general counsel of the governor. He used to be a litigator at Snell and Wilmer. And then after his tour at the governor's office with another firm, a national firm here, their local office, we'll see what he does with it. Yeah.
How do you think the issue of climate change or the reality of climate change, what kind of potential does it have to affect management decisions at Glen Canyon Dam and on the Colorado River? You said you think it could be a big deal. In what way?
Well, it depends on what the judge does with the case. You know, having filed the lawsuit, the issue about to manage that issue has basically been taken away from the executive branch and given to the judicial branch. And the judge will examine NEPA. Interestingly enough, the new draft NEPA quote regs unquote say that they can be applied to ongoing activities. Well, Amwig is an ongoing activity. What they do to the subject of dealing with alternatives, dealing with impacts like climate change. I mean, you have to say to yourself, what can they do about it? You know, what does operating reservoirs on the Colorado River have to do with climate change? You have to react to what is happening. For whatever reason, it doesn't make any difference what the reason is. You have to react to that. And so what do you do about it? And that nominally would be an executive decision under NEPA, is in the process of giving advice to a decision maker, here the Secretary of the Interior. But now we're in court, the same questions being asked. And come May, we will start the annual operating plan process for the Colorado River again. And I'm involved in that. And this last iteration just got signed here before it signed the last July. But they'll start this process again this spring, and I've even suggested to them that instead of waiting until May, they ought to start earlier. But it typically has three consultations in May, July, and September. And they put something together and give it to the secretary, and then he approves it, and that's the operating plan for the next year. Well, this AOP not only does not discuss climate change, it doesn't discuss DCP. So
the drought contingency plan.
Right, yeah. So I'm it's going to be an interesting spring because it's going to be interesting to see what people think they have to talk about in terms of, well, part of it is hydrology driven, and the report itself is based on the August 24-month study, and then the January 24-month study that just came out, and then ultimately for the rest of that calendar year, the April 20-month study, which is the end of March data. Right now, the predictions, where we are now is we've had a very good fall and winter so far. Oh dear, sorry about that. We were going to unplug that thing, weren't we?
I forgot.
Yeah.
You want to pause for just a second?
It's all right. All right. Keep going.
Ann, can you answer that and get rid of whoever it is?
That was a long ring, that last one.
It was.
Oh, it went away. Those are all
solicitation
calls. That's all right. They gave up.
So, if you don't mind, can we go back to something you said near the beginning? Go ahead and pause.
I'll pause. Resume recording.
If you don't mind, let's go back to something you said near the beginning of the interview. You mentioned that you have a number of clients who are interested in hydropower in the Columbia River Basin. Colorado River Basin. Did I say Columbia? Yeah, I used to live in Washington State, so it just came out of me. So the Glen Canyon Dam Adaptive Management Program is in essence, it's a collection of stakeholders trying to solve complex problems. And there are people who represent hydropower interests, water supply interests, wildlife interests, recreation interests, the national parks, tribal interests. Could you tell us a little bit more about, if you don't want to reveal your clients, at least what you represent, what you bring to the Adaptive Management Program in terms of your interests, what you're hoping to achieve in being involved?
Well, I represent a state association, most of whose members buy power from the Western Area Power Administration, generated among at other places other than Glen Canyon Dam up and down the river, but including Glen Canyon Dam. And it is, and they're primarily small, agriculturally based or rural towns.
Is this CRETA?
No.
A different organization.
No, CRETA is a regional association. Mm-hmm. Six states, but the types of entities that are in CRETA are the same types of entities that are in my state association, except that most of the ones we have are very small, and CRETAs are, a number of them are quite large. In any event, some of our people also get water off the Colorado River through the Central Arizona Project, and some of them get water off the river because they have their own water right, like the folks down in Yuma. And so we're one of the few places in the country where you sort of meet yourself coming and going, that you have people that are both in the Colorado River water business and the Colorado River power business. And so you have to be aware of the synergisms of decision making. You can see that in the Central Arizona, Central Valley Project in California. Hit the pause button. I'm afraid that's the...
Right.
I'm going to do the same thing I did last time. Resuming recording.
All right. Well, we were talking about the intersection of water and power issues. And in Arizona, we have an almost but not quite unique situation where an awful lot of the entities that buy power from the dams on the Colorado River also get water, either through their own organization or sister organizations formed for that purpose. So you have to see both sides of every impact, unlike most of the country where, or most of the West in reclamation projects, where you have water customers here and you have power customers over on the other side, they aren't the same people. And there's constant tension between them over who's paying for what and who's getting what. And it's just the nature of the beast. Power pays the bills on these projects. 95% of the bills of the Colorado River Storage Project are paid by hydropower sales. And so it's something most people, especially if they're water or environmental people, don't want to talk about. But it is a cruel reality that you have to keep an eye on what hydropower costs and who's, you know, are there people willing to still buy it? And the interesting thing about that is that fracking has changed the whole dynamic of the power business. Navajo Generating Station is not closing for environmental reasons. It's closed. It's already closed because it was no longer economical. It was cheaper to buy power at the Palo Verde Hub west of Phoenix than it was to run the plant. And other forces like that, gradually commercial wind and commercial solar, not rooftop solar, are getting cheaper and competing with other resources in terms of price. Their problem is that you can't schedule them. They either happen because the sun is shining or the wind is blowing, or they don't. I remember driving to church one Sunday and a cloud came over the sky, and I said, and my wife, APS and SRP are ramping up. Then the cloud went away and the sun came out again. And I said, now they're ramping down. And then, you know, and it went back and forth like that until we got in the parking lot. But it was true that every time that cloud went between the sun and the earth, the utilities had to change what they were doing, because the electricity that would have otherwise been generated by those solar arrays quit. So the complexities of what we do in the power business now are monumental compared to what they were 20 years ago. Things were, you know, but when we were talking about Glen Canyon Dam criteria, and stuff like that, and what it meant and what it would do to your power portfolio and this, that, and the other thing. You know, we're in a different world.
Yeah, I imagine you've seen a lot of changes over time, over the last 3 decades or so since the Adaptive Management Program began. Can you think back and reflect a little bit on what kinds of relationships between the stakeholders, the interest groups there were in the early years? Who was, you know, in conflict with who over what? And how maybe that evolved over time as things began to change?
Well, the river's driven by water. The river's driven by the 1922 Compact, the Upper Basin Compact, Arizona v. California, and other stuff, collectively, the law of the river. The 1930 Boulder Canyon Project regulations, the long-range operating criteria, now the shortage criteria, the interim shortage criteria, all of this stuff, and some other lawsuits. You know, but it's a huge collection of stuff. And power, to most people, is incidental to all the rest of this. And they keep saying, yes, this law says in power generation incidental there too. But the incidental there too is the checkbook. And everybody has always been able to assume that the power was cheaper than everything. It wasn't, actually. When the Commissioner of Reclamation testified in Congress about building the Colorado Storage Project, he said, I can sell this power at 6 mills for 50 years and build everything that's in here, the main stem reservoirs, the satellite projects, everything. Well, coal-fired steam was 4.5 mills. So that's a very big difference. You know, it doesn't sound like much when you're talking about mills, you know, percentages of a penny. But when you multiply it by what's being generated, you're talking today's price is $250 million a year. And 70% of that from Glen Canyon Dam for this particular project. So that, you know, the multiplier effect is huge, as long as everybody's buying the power. And over decades, it was just automatically assumed that the cheapest power you could possibly get was federal hydropower. Because that 6 mills being more than 4.5 mills for coal-fired steam didn't last very long. It wasn't that the 6 mills changed, the 4.5 mills changed dramatically. And so all of a sudden, all this hydropower, the stuff that was already there, Hoover, Davis, and Parker, the Parker-Davis project, looked better and better and better. And the Colorado River Storage Project power got into a position where it looked better and better and better. Interestingly enough, of those are the three major hydropower generating projects on the river, and among them only Parker Davis is below market. Crisp and Hoover are above market. You can buy power cheaper at Palo Verde Hub than you can buy it from the government, from Hoover Dam or Glen Canyon and the other dams north of there. But people do it to the extent it provides operational flexibility. Way back when this decision-making process was getting started, we had a group of us in the control center for Glen Canyon Dam with a congressman who this was 1993, was the ranking member of the House Energy Water Development Subcommittee that appropriates the money for reclamation and WMPA. And then after the 94 election, he became the subcommittee chairman with the switch. And it's down in the middle of the dam. And right in the middle of the room, and the reclamation official who was in charge of the facility was there explaining things to him and that sort of thing. And there's a bank of generators on the side, generator controls on the side. And in the middle of the room, there's a... Oh, jeez, I'm sorry.
Can I pause? Resuming recording.
Well, so we were in the control room, and in the middle of the control room is a desk, and on the desk is a red phone. And there's a young man sitting behind the desk. And the dam manager is explaining everything to this congressman, and the phone rings. And the young man picks it up, and he listens, and he puts it down, and he walks over to the wall, and he starts punching a button on one of the units, bringing it off spinning reserve. And a coal-fired unit in northwestern Colorado had tripped off for some reason, and the entire system in the Colorado River Basin was out of balance. And in the time it takes to tell this story, he had rebalanced the entire system. Now, that's incidental hydropower to everything else, thank you. But if he hadn't been able to do that, the system would have burned down. Electricity generates heat. That's why there are insulators. That's why there are circuit breakers, like the one that made me fall down in my hot tub. And I never had to explain to that congressman again what the value of Glen Canyon Dam and hydropower was, because it is, it's not a black start facility that Hoover is. It can go in and go from nothing to jump into the middle of a problem. But it plays an enormously big role in helping regulate electricity fluctuations in this whole interconnected system because it's of its size. And so while the hydropower is, quote, incidental, close quote, to water and whatever, it's not incidental if your lights go out. In the summer of 2001, before 9/11, it was very hot, and some power lines in eastern Idaho overloaded, as they do, and when they do, they sag. And because of all these issues with regard to deregulation and everything, one of the things that a lot of utilities cut back on was tree trimming. And so these wires sagged into a cottonwood tree, arced, and that pulse went to Boise, and the guys at Boise, Idaho couldn't react, and it went into the Bonneville Power Administration system, where there are no checks, down the Colorado-Oregon transmission project line to Northern California, down to LA, over here. And by the time it got here, Bureau had ramped Glen Canyon Dam. And our lights, we get solar project power. So we get power from Glen Canyon Dam. Our lights stayed on. Go over the other side of 7th Avenue, their lights went out. It's APS. 2 weeks later, Same thing happened, but the sag was on the COTP going from Grand Coulee down into Northern California. At that point, Glen Canyon was 100% because they were rolling blackouts in California, and there was no other, there's no other power. And so our lights went out as well because there was nothing to throw at the problem. But people don't understand, you know, that from British Columbia to northern New Mexico, this is all connected. And the problems, for instance, they're having in California now, really can have an impact on us. And while California turns its nose up at resources outside the state, it doesn't when the lights go out. And they're going to go out again this summer. So we're in a, as you said, we're in a different world, and not one I would have chosen, but one I think that bears further reflection on how people view the hydropower generated at Glen Canyon Dam. It has been the whipping boy during this entire process. You know, it's bad, the dam is bad, the hydropower is bad. And I have waited a very long time for some precipitating cause that would force perhaps a recalculation of the relative values of things. And oddly enough, I think this lawsuit by the environmentalists may be that precipitating cause, because it's going to examine what Amwick has been doing and whether it's been doing it correctly. And the environmentalists are saying, no, you haven't, this group of environmentalists. I would love to see a poll among environmental groups as to which of them like this idea of this lawsuit and which of them don't. The more sophisticated ones, I think, probably don't like it at all, because it's, as I said, it's taking decision-making away from the executive branch and putting it in the judicial branch. But we'll see where it goes. In the meantime, we've got to keep lights on.
What do you think, in the years that you've been involved, do you think you've been able to accomplish anything in particular in terms of keeping the importance of hydropower on the table, maybe making some, having some influence on decisions that are made about, you know, operation of the dam?
Oh, some. When this all really got rolling, a professor from ASU and a couple of people took some readings from 40L, that's a beach, and said, the sky is falling, we got to have emergency criteria. And Interior went along with it, and I yelled and screamed and whatnot, and then we got to the 97 criteria, and some of the more onerous things of those emergency criteria things went away. I like to think in part because they thought I was going to sue them, and they, you know, as I said before, you know, I mean,
could you be more specific about what was in the emergency criteria that you thought was not a good idea, and how that changed afterward?
The restrictions on Glen Canyon Dam were tighter, more severe than what we ended up with in the 97 criteria. And the problem with the 97 criteria, for instance, one of there are five controls. There's a minimum, a maximum, up ramp, down ramp, and daily change. All right. There's no scientific evidence for what they have in the way of an upfront criterion. The problem is that when they looked themselves in the face and said, what do we do with this? It was not 6,000, 8,000, and the more nuanced version of that concept in the new decision making. But they had to come up with something they couldn't bear politically, saying, well, of the five criteria, we don't really need this one. And as a practical matter, what they did was set the criteria, the criterion for upramping, or criteria under different water flows for criteria, for upramping, so that it didn't make any difference. If the daily change is 6,000 to 8,000, then the ramping, upramping doesn't make any difference, because you eat it in an hour or two, and that's not load following. And so it really doesn't mean anything. But now I don't know if I'll live long enough, but I want to live to the point where people begin to think that maybe there's a win-win situation in this. You know, they do these artificial floods. They don't do anything. I mean, I've been there. I've been on the river. I've been on the river seven times, starting in the 70s. I was on the river on a private trip in 2000 when they flattened the river, and I was in the in 2008 when they started the experimental flows, the floods, which of course deeply incised the edges of the beaches so that you could hardly get onto them until it eroded. And every time they do one of those floods, the sand goes back in the river in about 6 months, almost all of it, because the flood can only put the sand up high enough to where the water is, and therefore as the water withdraws and it dries out, but there is subsurface erosion, it loses its support and it falls back in the river. And it, so it really is, it's not beach building. There are 110 camping beaches between Glen Canyon Dam and Lake Mead. Virtually all of them in the lower river are as big or bigger than they were before Glen Canyon Dam was built. There's a Park Service photographic study that was done to mimic one that was Powell did under contract to try to map a railroad to the river, along the river. And they did it on the each spot, this very same day, very same time of day and everything. And in the amount of area of the river that is exactly the same is striking. And nobody wants to talk about it. The Park Service in Tucson has this photographic study comparison 100 years to the day of each of those two. And the real problem is Marble Canyon. It's got maybe 75% narrow configuration. It's configured to channel the normal westerly flow of winds. I know I've gotten a nasty sunburn from sand blowing in my face in Marble Canyon and lost a nice hat that said Coors on it to the river and my pillow because, you know, that wind can get pretty fierce in that narrow. But even under the old criteria, 31,500 and three in the summer and one in the winter, before the 97 criteria, in the narrowest reach of Marble Canyon, the change in water level was 10 feet. That's all. And you can tell. And you can tell pre-dam there'd be scouring floods up to 300,000 CFS and some at 100. And you can go down there and you can see the striations of vegetation where those lines are. And you'll see trees above 300,000, you'll see some shrubs down, and then you'll go down below, and you get down into where we are now, and the maximum fluctuation is 3 feet instead of 10 feet. And then from 3 to 10, there are grasses and salt cedar until the bugs get them. And that's where the problem is, the real problem. And it's an engineering problem. In my view, instead of trying to, you know, Einstein's definition of insanity was repeating the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. Well, they've been doing this, you know, these artificial floods, expecting a different result. The ones they do in the spring excite the rainbow trout. They reproduce more. They then out-compete, or they compete with and eat humpback chub. The studies are there. They've been done. It's the fatal flaw of the spring HFE. The fall HFEs screw other things up. You could go down there with some civil engineers and a survey crew. I used to work on a survey crew in high school with a transit and a level and stake out the 40,000 CFS line. The Bureau of Reclamation's got dredges on the lower Colorado River. They go through the National Wildlife Refuges, blowing sand out of the river at the request of the Fish and Wildlife Service to keep the channels open. And it works. And you can break them down, put them on trucks, drive them through the tunnel, put them on pontoon boats, reassemble them, go down to where you need to purchase sand when the sand is accumulated, and put it together again. You put the little sonar bell in the water and give it a beep and scare the fish away. You shoot the sand up to the grade stakes. You break everything down, pull the sonar bell out, go up, pick up the grade stakes, float down the river, and the only people who'll know that you were even there are the river runners. And you'll have a beach that'll be there 100 years. Which is, you know, I mean, that's fine. I mean, what you're doing is promoting a business, commercial river running. And, the small group of people who do private trips get along with whatever there is, but you have to have a comfort zone for commercial river running, and you have to have beaches that are nice. And you can do that. And it wouldn't do anything for the backwaters, but humpback chub don't use the backwaters anyway, and besides, they freeze over in the fall. And when they're not frozen over, the water birds eat the fish that are there because it's shallow. I mean, this stuff is in the record.
Can you explain briefly why hydropower interests are not enamored with the idea of the high flow events? Why would you not want the high flow events to continue? Is that because the water doesn't go through the turbine and generate electricity when there's an HFE? Okay.
Yeah, it costs them money, it costs their customers money, and if they worked, then it'd be one thing. But when the sand falls back in the river, and the other aspect of it is, it does fall back in the river, then they do another one, guess where that sand goes? It goes into Lake Mead. Before they started this, there's a little bit of sand up at the head of Lake Mead. Now there's a huge sandbar up there, quixotically full of salt cedar and southwestern willow flycatcher, which isn't playing the game fairly and is nesting in salt cedar, which is not the script it's supposed to follow. And so you have this tension now over that whole thing. But that great big sandbar didn't exist before. We're pulsing sand down toward Lake Mead. We're shortening the life of Lake Mead, its ability to store water without being dredged, which is, and then dredging a reservoir is an environmental nightmare because of heavy metals and everything else that settles in the bottom of reservoirs. It's the nature of the beast. And you can't very well sluice that stuff downstream without sluicing all of those pollutants downstream. To me, we could get a win-win out of this. It's there, but it would need for people to alter a mindset, and we've had this mindset go through what, how many generations? I mean, think of the people who started working on this in the Glen Canyon Environmental Studies, and that's what,
40, 50 years now.
No, it's 29 years ago, 1992.
Oh, the Glen Canyon Environmental Studies began in the early 1980s, and discussions about the problems associated with the dam began even before that.
Yes. So. Yeah, so, I mean, really, you're talking about three decades. Mm-hmm. So you get people who have literally graduated college, had a career, and are retired. And you have young people coming along, and I find myself dealing with people's grandchildren, and I start saying, well, you know, in 1970, and they look at me, or not even that far back,
what's the change of mind frame that you said is needed in order to get a win-win situation?
People have to accept the fact that you have to do something mechanical in the Grand Canyon. Now, that's two lies cobbled together. First of all, you don't need to do it in the Grand Canyon, you do it in Marble Canyon. And second, this isn't the only mechanical thing that's done in spite of what people from primarily the Park Service and the environmental community will say in the, quote, Grand Canyon, the general term usually used for everything from Glen Canyon Dam to Lake Mead. They put helicopters down there when they need to, both for rescue and for whatever other task they do, mechanical harvesting of exotic fish. There is a mound of sand at the toe of Glen Canyon Dam, which is causing back pressure on its operation. And they are actively considering having to dredge that out of there, which means they'd have to get one of those dredges I'm talking about that the Bureau has, break it down, put it on the trucks, take it through the tunnel, put it on reassemble it, or put. Now they probably have to put it on the boats and then and drive up a little to reassemble it, and then use it to try to sluice that sand mound away. I've been there. I've fished it. And it's a significant operational issue. It's mechanical. The stuff they do about exotic fish is mechanical. We could do the sand preservation for commercial river running in Marble Canyon, where it's the only place where it would really be helpful. One trip, we get that sand perched above a 40,000 CFS line, which would be in the very narrowest part of the canyon, 10 feet. Float everything down the river, come back in 100 years. The only thing you can be facing at that point is wind erosion. And it would work. But people go nuts when you say things like that to them, because it's the Grand Canyon. It's a wilderness. Well, it's not a wilderness. And yet, if you did that, you wouldn't have to do the artificial floods. You wouldn't be worried about their adverse impacts on the endangered humpback chub. And then I don't know about bug flows in the fall. That's a new recent phenomenon. They plant rainbow trout from time to time in the Lee Ferry fishery. I don't know why they can't plant bugs instead of flattening the river on the weekends. It's not as economically consequential as doing things during the week, but it is more consequential in the summer when that power is needed. And it seemed to me that if you can raise fish and put them in the river, you can raise bugs and put them in the river, and it's an awful lot cheaper than not generating electricity. But you've got to have the mindset to say, let's think outside the box. Let's see, can we have our cake and eat it too? Can we take this hydropower resource back toward what it was designed to be because of the benefits that can generate for just this load following, for supporting wind and solar, getting people off of carbon resources? Can we think about it? This hydropower facility is very important to other policy issues that have now arisen and people are beginning to coalesce around, that we need to have a more carbon-free environment. And there is a role for hydropower to play in that, existing hydropower primarily, because most of the big dams that will ever be built in Western United States have been built. And that's just the way life is. In part because, there aren't that many more dam sites worth considering. But until people think, improving hydropower at Glen Canyon Dam is worth trying, can we marry mitigating downstream impacts and innovation with that and see if we can make it work? Can we? I don't know. I mean, I think you can. I think there are available solutions. I don't think it's rocket science. I think there are current applications of engineering and biology that can be applied. I think that the power customers, for instance, who fund so much of this if they were not losing $5 million a day in hydropower costs. Might be very happy to spend $500,000 on bugs. You know, I mean, it's economics. But you have to have the mindset that looks at the whole picture and says, gee, is there a way we can do this for everybody? It's a way, you know, instead of fighting with each other, instead of bad-mouthing each other, is there a path forward on this that where everybody wins? And I don't know if that's possible.
Yeah. Well, that is exactly the purpose of an adaptive management program. It's kind of an experimental effort to bring all the stakeholders together to see if you can find, collaboratively agree on as many win-wins as possible. It's experimental, and it's an alternative to the normal way of making decisions. I wonder, and you know, we can kind of wrap up this interview with this, I wonder if you think that adaptive management as an alternative way of making decisions about resources is kind of a successful experiment or more of a muddle that hasn't really accomplished what it sought out to accomplish. What are your feelings about adaptive management in this particular
program? Let me ask you this question. What has it accomplished?
That's why I'm interviewing experts like you. Some people think a lot has been accomplished. Other people feel frustrated. I'm wondering what you feel about it.
You know,
democracy is messy, of course.
Of course.
And slow and frustrating sometimes.
And better than everything else.
Exactly.
But, let's put it this way. Under the old regime, we didn't have green sunfish. Under the old regime, while the Fish and Wildlife Service had run on the river and created the endangered fish problem, and put brown trout, German brown trout, they're from Germany, because they are hard to catch, they fight like hell, and they mostly camped out in Bright Angel Creek and in the river right around there. Now they're migrating up, and the people who make a living off of the leaf eyed fishery with the rainbows are very unhappy. I mean, just like they were when the Game and Fish Department put cantaloupes, it's a type of rainbow trout, it's a strain in there, and nobody could catch it. And so they put bellairs in there, and they're really stupid. And, and a biologist friend of mine said that they should have put in Rocky Mountain, it's a different strain. But point is, it's a fish that's native to the west slopes of the Sierra Nevadas, Northern California and Southern Oregon. And it's not native here. We have two native trout. Neither of them were in the Colorado River. It was a warm water river. They're in the Blue, the San Francisco, and the Little Colorado, the Apache and the Gila. And they're not very bright either. They're much easier to catch. But the problem is that we just look at this and say, all right, now we've got humpback chub populations in some of the side streams. The original target for delisting humpback chub was 3,000 reproducing adults. We're at 9. Fish and Wildlife Service is struggling with itself over downlisting this population to threatened, not delisting, downlisting, because it's the Grand Canyon. It's politics, and the politics is interfering with what it should have been a science call 15 years ago. And eventually, maybe we'll get there. I don't know if this lawsuit's going to screw that up or not. But we have environmental problems now we didn't have. I caught striped bass at the mouth of Havasu Creek on one of our trips with the Bureau of Reclamation, as did a Bureau of Reclamation guy. And Dave Wagner, oh, what happened? Oh, I'm sorry.
I unplugged it, but I go ahead.
I'm going to start. Resuming recording.
Well, you know, Dave and I were nemesis.
Nemesis, you said?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
He had his own idea about how he was doing things, and I wasn't particularly fond of the direction he was taking things. But, and there's, you can come back for another 4 hours and we'll talk about my relationship with David, but I still see him from time to time, and we commiserate. I used to see him when he went up on the Hill. He's in the minority staff of the Transportation Subcommittee, and my middle daughter, who called, was Chief Counsel of the Crime, Terrorism, and Homeland Security Subcommittee, and her office was right across the hall. And then there was another subcommittee right next to her, so I could go into the basement of the Rayburn Building and get a threefer. To me, I mean, David let us, what we did is he made us clean the fish, bag the entrails, put them on ice. We had a striped bass snack before dinner. And that stuff went back to have the scientists poke around and see what they were eating. But those fish had portaged lava. I mean, think about it. And striped bass are an anadromous fish, native to the Atlantic Ocean and, among other places, rivers that flow into the Atlantic Ocean from the United States. And were brought to the West because they're great sports fish. I caught a 60-pound one in San Francisco Bay when I was 8. Actually, it caught me and my father, and the boat captain got it aboard, and they had to whack the thing and kill it before we'd get it aboard for fear it would bite somebody's leg off. And then took it back to officers' quarters. My father was briefly stationed at Benicia Arsenal. Took great big chunks of the fillet, threw it in the bathtub, poured ice over it, took the head, put it out the empty lot next door that had a post on it. And the bees took care of that. And then went around trying to give fish away. But striped bass are a wonderful fighting fish and wonderful sports fish and wonderful eating fish. But they are the freshwater sharks of the United States. And they're in Lake Mead and they're in Lake Powell for that very reason. And if you create a climate between Glen Canyon Dam and Lake Mead for them, there won't be any more humpback chub or rainbow trout or even brown trout, because they will dominate everything. They're like the golden eagles. I mean, everybody says, oh, the bald eagle, bald eagle. The only reason the golden eagle's not the symbol of the United States is it was the symbol of Germany before then, when they were trying to decide But the golden eagle dominates the bald. And I have a Nantuit Creek, which is, Middle Granite Gorge, coming in from the north side, and it's a spawning area for rainbow trout. And I have seen bald eagles standing alongside the creek, fishing, and a golden eagle come down, and the bald eagles leave. And, of course, the Grand Canyon was never natural habitat for eagles of any kind. Until they introduced the rainbow trout, but that's how big a threat striped bass are to that ecosystem. Nobody can explain how the green sunfish got into that little eddy below Glen Canyon Dam. They have tried to poison it out. They've done this, done that. They haven't fixed it yet. They haven't figured out why the German brown trout are migrating north up the river. And they got another fish problem up in Cataract Canyon. Asian carp, and it's a breeding population. My biologists that I use tell me it's only a matter of time before they get down below the dam. They live a very long time. They eat everything. I mean, they eat moss and whatnot, and plankton, and fish. They're used in the Salt River Project system, and the triploids are used in the Salt River Project system in every lake, on every golf course here. And we were using diploids here, and some of them started breeding, and they were being purchased from hatcheries in Arkansas. We passed a law that I got involved in to required triploids, and they had to go drain everything to get rid of these fish. And in the part of the Arizona Canal that runs through Sunny Slope, we had all these Vietnamese come in and settle up there. And they were draining this and trying to capture these fish. And every time the SRP guys turned around, they'd go down and steal the fish. I mean, it's Asian carp. Mekong River, hello. It was dinner. They couldn't believe it. And but now we have triploids, and they work, and that's fine. But not in Cataract. How they got in Cataract Canyon, God only knows. But they're there, and we have all these threats. Now these are warm water species. The water comes out of the dam at, 50, 52? When they flattened the river in 2000, we bathed in the river while camped at a beach in Middle Granite Gorge. It was that warm. That's not good. You can't have that. You can't flatten the river. And yet some people think flattening the river is, in fact, the solution. But it can't be, because if you warm that river, nature's going to create a habitat that these other species will want to occupy. It's a basic principle of biology, as I'm sure you're aware, that a species will occupy whatever habitat it can that's suitable for it. Ever since this whole thing started, every time we've fiddled with something, there's the law of unintended consequences has reared its ugly head. Salt cedar. When we first started floating the river in the 70s, private trips, there was hardly any salt cedar at Lee Ferry. And now there's this huge bosque So they get this beetle, and they put it on the salt cedar in the Virgin River, and it does its job. And they thought, all right, it'll eat its way down the Virgin River and die, and just go away and be nice. Wrong. Now it's gradually working its way up to Colorado. But the southwestern willow flycatcher is nesting, you know, is not playing the script, you know, with the script properly, and it's nesting in the salt cedar. It's adapting. And that has now created, you know, yet another problem. And all of this fiddling has, to me, put in question this, the way people think in this adaptive management work group. Everybody has their own agenda. Everybody's pushing their own aspect of thing and their own personal belief. And nobody's looking at an overall picture. I mean, think how many decades we've been at this. And we don't have a solution. This is, you said, it's an experimental program. When does the experiment end? When do you get solutions? When can you say, aha, we have been conducting experiments here for 40 years, and we now have solutions. This is what we ought to do. We're not anywhere near there. You can't even get the people who go to the meetings to agree on a particular strategy other than doing the next study. And you know, that's what scientists like to do. God love them. But if we're gonna get somewhere, somebody's got to take control of this situation and shape it toward some realistic future, to me. And that's what's missing. There's no control here. It's amorphous. Everybody's study is fine. I mean, who's going to criticize somebody else's study? Because then, if you do that, then when you do your study, they'll criticize yours. It's one of the problems you have with peer review, is you got to be very careful about what you say about somebody else's work. You know, it's one of the things lawyers don't have to put up with. You know, we don't expect other lawyers to compliment us on our work. Nor should they expect us to compliment them. And, you know, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. Being a lawyer is a process of confrontation. But to me, the whole thing just isn't pointed toward a result. Nobody said, okay, you've got 5 more years and then you're done. Or you've got to do this. Or you've got to do that. It's all, well, we have this next study we're going to do, and everybody says, isn't that wonderful? And we've got this study, and isn't that wonderful? And we've tried this. Well, the planning of the humpback chub and all these tributaries has worked. But what happens if we don't solve the German brown trout issue? What happens if people who like the idea of flattening the river let the river warm up and we get striped bass in the river? I mean, there's many, many things have been tried, and the oops factor has bitten us. And starting with rotenoning the river that created the endangered fish problem in the first place. Because they wanted to put recreational fish in the river for people to enjoy. But there are solutions, but the solutions are going to require a change in mindset, in my view. People are going to want to have answers and want to have each other's interests mature into solutions that make sense and that provide value to each of the interests involved in the thing. They're going to want everybody to win. And that ain't there now. Not even close.
I think that's an excellent place to wrap up. That's probably one of the most articulate criticisms we've had of the program in our oral history interview. So that was very valuable. Thank you. Thank you for that.
Well, that'll teach you to come to my house and drink my Tangelo juice.
That was excellent Tangelo juice.